From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, we'll hear about Milwaukee County DA John Chisholm's 17 years in office as he prepares to depart. Then we'll visit Frank Lloyd Wright's Taliesin home to hear about a $1 million restoration project.
We get to see a different side of Wright here, where he was such a complex person, and you don't quite get that when you're visiting the houses that he built for other people.
Plus, get a sneak peek to learn how Forest Home Cemetery becomes a stage for a few of their notable residents.
We really wanted to bring alive the residents of Forest Home Cemetery because their stories are so compelling and amazing. We wanted to do it in a way that was entertaining.
All that's coming up on Lake Effect, but first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us. Milwaukee County District Attorney John Chisholm is not seeking re-election this November. He's been at the helm of the office for 17 years and was an assistant DA for a dozen years before that. Chisholm's chief deputy, Kent Lovern, is running uncontested for the office. The district attorney prosecutes criminal offenses that occur in the county, from misdemeanors to felonies. Outgoing DA Chisholm spoke with WUWM's race and ethnicity reporter Taryn Powell about his time in office. He begins by explaining his decision not to seek re-election.
You know, there's a lot of reasons that go into a decision to move on. And one of the biggest issues that I had to assess was, where was the office in terms of the commitments that I had made when I first ran in 2006? Did I feel like we had made substantial progress to achieving a lot of the goals that I aspired to back in 2006? Secondly, how about the stability of the office? And at this particular time, I feel like I have a really, really accomplished and experienced executive team. I've got a lot of young, very excellent prosecutors coming in and starting to excel at the practice as well. But that's been really a difficult time for really, say, the last 10 years or more, where we've really been challenged to retain people in the office because of the low wages and the conditions. And so that's another factor that weighed into it when the legislature recently adjusted the compensation for assistant DAs across the state. What we've seen since then is that the assistant DAs are staying, and they're not leaving to go into a higher paying government job or the private practice. Those are three of the factors. And I would say really the final factor is that there's a changing relationship, I would say, between the county and the city of Milwaukee and the state as a whole, in that the recent changes, for example, giving the city and the county some flexibility in how they address some of their revenue deficits, that allows greater flexibility, greater stability for both the city and the county. And that affects me in the sense that my support staff are all county funded. And so the same problems that we had with the assistant DAs we were having with the county support staff as well, because they just weren't being adequately compensated for the really difficult work. So that's starting to stabilize as well. And so this is just a good time for me to move on and for another person to take the helm and run with it.
You mentioned one of the considerations for stepping back was seeing where the office was in terms of your early goals you set when you were first elected. What were some of those goals?
Well, the goals remain fairly consistent. And what I would describe them as, we always made a distinction in our profession, how we dealt with individuals that came into the criminal justice system, between those who were committing violent and harmful offenses against themselves and other people. And so we always made a clear distinction between people engaged in dangerous and violent behavior, whether it's the use of firearms, reckless driving, you know, sexually violent people, people hurting children, people who are engaging in violent domestic behavior. All of those were were cases where there had to be an intervention and the criminal justice system was an appropriate intervention for those individuals. What we also made a distinction for, however, were the large number of people that at the time were coming into the system who were dealing with other issues in addition to whatever else brought them to the criminal justice system. But that meant we had a lot of people with mental health issues. We had a lot of people that were dealing with traumatic lives themselves, who had been exposed to lots of violence, alcohol addiction. All of those factors we looked at, and we tried to develop some different pathways for those individuals, but always keeping a balance between public safety and a desire to engage with the community to make the community not just safer, but also healthier.
As you reflect on your time as the Milwaukee County District Attorney, what are you most proud of?
It's always the people. The reality is, in this position, I've been privileged to bring several hundred people over the last 18 years into the profession, and that's both the support staff and as assistant DAs to serve the community. And what I look for is just a good person that is actually committed to doing the job in an ethical way, doing the job in a committed and passionate way, and somebody that's going to treat the people who come to us with dignity and respect and compassion, but be appropriately firm and disciplined when that's required as well. So I'm looking for good people, and I've been privileged to work with a lot of really, really good people.
What's been the most challenging part of the job?
Well, everything is challenging. It's probably, when you look at it, at least being the district attorney of Milwaukee County puts you in a position to make really important decisions over more people than almost any other elected position in the state. And there's a handful of other ones that you might have more influence over them. But the prosecutor's role, the district attorney's role at the end of the day, is to really focus that lens of state authority, state power, on an individual. And when you do that, you have to balance that person's civil rights, their ability to live in a free society and exercise those rights, with the need for making sure that we keep the community safe as well. So that's the job. You're balancing that all the time. And when you make a decision, the police can arrest everybody they want to arrest. At the end of the day, nobody stays in the system unless a prosecutor makes a decision to initiate formal criminal proceedings against them. And so that's a unique privilege, a unique power of the prosecutor. And it's got to be exercised with restraint. It's got to be exercised, again, in a principled way. And again, there's got to be a purpose behind it. And that purpose, ideally, should be to keep your community safe, ideally create conditions that make it healthier, and then therefore allow people to prosper in that community. So you're trying always to maintain the social compact. That's what you're doing. And when I describe that as the core function of the prosecutor, is trying to maintain that social compact, that's a difficult thing to do. It really is, because people in a major urban city like Milwaukee, they come from really diverse backgrounds, experiences, all sorts of different economic circumstances. And so all of these things come together and create a dynamic that's not unique to Milwaukee, but it's on a different scale, is one way to say it. I mean, every community experiences the same thing, but the scale in Milwaukee compared to any other area or jurisdiction in Wisconsin is just much larger. So that's part of the things that you're challenged with every day, and you're trying to make the community as safe and as healthy as you possibly can.
What do you want your legacy to be?
I'm always reticent to speak about legacies, because I think that this is just a fact of elected office, and that is, 1 minute you're out of the office, you will be forgotten. And that's the way it should be. In a healthy democracy, you should just move on and allow the next person up to serve and imprint their vision and idea of how the organization should run and how it should be received by the community. So ultimately it would be that I really took the job or ran for the job originally and accepted the job when I was privileged to be elected in 2006 for one major reason, and that was that I believed really, really strongly in the ethos of the office that had been created by my predecessor, by E. Michael McCann, and that was the culture within the office that really, really imprinted on each one of us that our job was, to the best of our ability, do the right thing. In other words, make sure that you didn't charge people if you couldn't prove it.
D.A. Chisholm, you said part of moving on from a position means letting the next person come up and imprint their vision on how they think things should be run. In the case of the new district attorney in Milwaukee County, that would be Kent Lovern. What advice would you give to him?
Well, first and foremost, you're absolutely right. I like to refer to Kent as an upgrade. I'm like Windows 98, and he's coming in as an upgrade. But look, Kent and I have worked together almost nonstop since I started the Firearms Enforcement Unit back in late 1999, mm-hmm. and he was one of the first assistant DAs assigned to my unit at that time. And so, we've been working very closely with one another. So, I don't really have to give him a lot of advice. I've taken a lot of advice from him over the years, and that's been incredibly valuable to me as well. But what I would say is that it is different when it's your name on every decision. It really is. And so the only practical advice I can give him is just to be prepared for basically everything being your responsibility during this time. And I know he is, and he's going to do an awesome job.
So with that being said, are there any decisions you signed off on that you think back and maybe you would have decided differently?
It's a great question. I come from the experience that I had in the military where they required you after every single mission, every operation, to step back and evaluate how you performed. And how you performed as an individual, how you performed as an organization, did you accomplish the mission? If you didn't, why not? And what they would always emphasize is that those were not supposed to be blaming exercises. Those were supposed to be learning exercises. In other words, it was always forward-looking. You wanted to, because the work is by definition adversarial, chaotic. Oftentimes you're just dealing with the unexpected all the time. And so you have to operate on certain principles, but you have to apply those principles differently to each situation. And so I can't identify just one example of something that didn't go the way we wanted to, because quite frankly, you'll find cases every single day of the week in our courthouse that might not go the way we wanted to. You know, we win most of our cases, you know, that's great, but we don't assess ourselves on wins and losses, right? Because even a win is a loss to somebody, and so the real question is, you know, could I have done something better? And so we do that all the time, and so there isn't any one particular incident that I look back on. There's been a mix of successes, there's been a mix of partial success, partial failure, and then there's been failures. But I've been committed to learning from all of them and just trying to improve the process as we go along.
So, what are your plans for the future?
I would like to stay in the policy space. You know, I think that the criminal justice system in the United States is, there is no such thing as a criminal justice system in the United States, because there's like 3,000 plus different jurisdictions that each one of them deal with processing allegations of crime in their community a little bit different. You know, each one of them has a little bit different culture. But there are some universal principles that I think every DA's office should have. And those are some of the things that I've worked on both locally here, but also even at the national level. I would like to continue that work. I think it's really important. I don't really think the quality of justice that you receive should varies so dramatically just because of some artificial boundary, right? You know, why should you have a different experience in Waukesha County than you have in Milwaukee County? Or why should it be different if you're from Illinois? And that's one of, isn't that one of the concerns that people have about, you know, having reproductive rights? Why should your autonomy be different in the state of Wisconsin than it is in some other state? Those are approaches that I feel pretty strongly about, that we should be making that distinction that I started with early in my career, which is, you know, let's appropriately try to stop individuals that are harming other individuals, but also let's get to some of the root causes of why people hurt other people. And let's do that by figuring out some of those fundamental problems that can exist in a community that oftentimes just go unaddressed. You know, whether that's gross economic disparity, whether it's a lack of opportunities in education, dysfunctional school systems, you know, violence. Violence in a community is what drives bad policy. I've said that for years. And so you really have to get a handle on the violence and come up with solutions to it that aren't simply police-based strategies, right?
Well, D.H. Chisholm, I want to thank you so much for sharing your time with me. I really appreciate it.
Pleasure.
That was outgoing Milwaukee County District Attorney John Chisholm speaking with WUWM race and ethnicity reporter Taryn Powell. Kent Lovern is running to replace Chisholm as Milwaukee County DA. For more information about the candidates on your ballot on November 5th, go ahead and visit our voter guide at wuwm.com/voterguide. Architect Frank Lloyd Wright designed projects around the globe, including his home and studio outside of Spring Green, Wisconsin, called Taliesin. Recently, its theater reopened after a years-long $1 million restoration. WUWM's Susan Bentz was there for the celebration of Hillside Theater, along with a crowd of Wright enthusiasts. Susan talked to Taliesin Collections Coordinator Kyle Dockery about the significance of the building and the story of the restoration.
My favorite two pieces in the theater are these two larger-than-life Chinese Buddhist statues. They're carved wood, and everyone, when you look at them, they look like they're bronze because they have this blackened appearance. And that's because they were in Hillside in 1952 when the fire occurred. And so they were next to the portion of the building that burned, and they collected all of the soot from the fire. They're very beautiful in spite of that damage, maybe even more beautiful because of it. And Wright chose to install one of them in the theater, right on stage left, in a very prominent spot, looking directly at the audience. And so as we conserved that as part of this project, it was really amazing to see how much detail there was that was hidden underneath there, that with just a little bit of attention just revealed itself. So the statues that I was talking about, those went to the Midwest Art Conservation Center in Minneapolis. It's actually right in the basement of the Minneapolis Institute of Art. But other pieces have been conserved on site here, like the Hillside Theater curtain. We conserved that in 2020, and just because of its size, it's easiest to handle here. So they came out to us and cleaned the curtain and repaired some of the most damaged fabric, this metallic gold lamé.
So the celebration of the moment is the theater, which began as a schoolhouse?
Yes. So the Wright, for one of Wright's very first architectural commissions, was for his aunt's boarding school, the Hillside Home School. This was in 1887. He was only 20 years old. He designed a much more traditional building than you would expect from Frank Lloyd Wright. And then in 1902, he is commissioned by his aunts to build a much larger school, which included classrooms, a gymnasium, and a couple of dedicated art and science rooms. The school closed in 1915 after the horrific first fire at Taliesin in 1914. And 17 years later, when Frank Lloyd Wright founded the Taliesin Fellowship, they began working on renovating that building. And one of their first projects was to turn the old gymnasium into a theater, which finished in 1933. It had this upper level running track, and they turned that into a balcony for the theater. They got a movie projector, and it became a kind of an art house cinema of sorts. And then in April of 1952, they set a brush fire a little too close to the building, which destroyed the theater and the dining room wing next to it. And so immediately they began work on constructing a new theater, and they built it on the same footprint of the original one, utilizing some of the original masonry that had already been standing for 50 years. Wright connected with this building in a way that he did not connect with many, you know, over
so
a decade.
What was that connection?
It's a good place to experiment because he doesn't have any clients that he needs to satisfy. He's doesn't need to be too concerned about budget, just because of his creative accounting. So he could test out a lot of ideas here, and so it's sort of interesting how the Hillside Theater in Taliesin draws from ideas that they had developed just a year earlier in building the Cabaret Theater at Taliesin West, which has this angled seating and a concrete roof.
You've been here about 7 years, did you say? What was the state of Hillside when you came on?
It was a very beautiful theater, but it needed a lot of help. The backstage area was completely unfinished and just unpleasant to be in. Just all the facilities, the lighting, sound, all of that left a lot to be desired.
So you talked about the sculpture that has been restored and is sort of has a pivotal position there. What are some of the other elements that make the space so special now?
Probably the most prominent piece of the whole room is the curtain. Wright designed it after the fire, and it's this abstract composition of felt and yarn. It's said to be an example of the Taliesin landscape rendered into these geometric figures. It was made by the Fellowship. Wright designed the curtain himself, but he wasn't present for the construction of it. So when they opened the theater, reopened the theater in 1956 on Wright's 89th birthday, it came to as a surprise to him. It's a remarkable piece of work because Wright had made a lot of these designs in various formats for graphic design, magazine covers, rugs and everything. And this is sort of the grandest vision of that. It's the largest one that he ever imagined. And it's just so, so intricate. I mean, the piece is beautiful and the design is one of my favorites.
So did I read that at the time he added a finishing touch, he didn't think it was quite right? Did it involve instant coffee?
That's right. Shortly after it was unveiled, he or an apprentice were up on a ladder, touching up the very top portion of it with a little bit of Nescafe to give it just a slight brown tinge, which you can clearly see today.
So what was involved in bringing that back to life? Did it just need a good cleaning or what?
The first part is that we just had to understand what we were looking at because it's about 30 feet long and 12 feet tall. So I looked at the original design and basically just developed a grid system and then basically just looked the entire thing top to bottom and identified where everything that was damaged. And so a lot of it was just cleaning, just basically a getting a vacuum with a good HEPA filter on it. And then there are a lot of these yarn swags, which have a tendency to break, as just as any bit of yarn does. So there are a lot of those that needed to be replaced. And then the most critical part was the gold lame border at the bottom. You know, as the bottom of any curtain does, it's going to tend to catch on things over time. The original material is not in good enough condition to be saved. So we kept that in place and then basically sewed another layer of new gold lame over it. So that original material is all there from what at least hadn't been torn away at some point, and we'll be able to study it in the future if we need to, but it looks bright and shiny now.
Any other aspect of the theater that you'd like to point to?
It's a very small theater. We only have 100 seats, and so it was critical to us to have received a donation that allowed us to bring in cameras and microphones so that we can stream events to people around the world, and we're looking forward to being able to do that more.
So over your time, your life so far with Frank Lloyd Wright, what is standing out to you most as you consider it today?
Well, one of the other pieces in the theater which we are working on is a large Chinese Coromandel lacquer screen. It's 10 feet tall. The original piece is not in a condition that it can be displayed anymore, so we are seeking funds to be able to conserve it. But it plays a critical role in the theater, both functionally and artistically. We're able to get photos of it, high quality, high resolution photos, and make a one-to-one replica of it, which looks almost perfect on it. And so you have to get very close to notice the pixels. It's a beautiful piece. It's a type of Chinese lacquer work. It tends to be fairly uncommon. The way it's created is that get the boards of the screen, apply a layer of lacquer to it, and then cut away the figures so that there's like a 3D, bit of a 3D quality to it. And then there are layers of paint and gold leaf and everything. And so it's a giant screen. And Wright acquired it from a Japanese art dealer, Yamanaka & Company, one of a few Japanese businesses who were actually seized by the government during World War II. Wright bought this from them in January of 1942. And he didn't end up paying the full amount because the company was seized before they could collect all of his bills. And in the chaos of the war, his debt just got forgotten. So there's quite a story there, and he purchased a number of other things from this company. It's a story that we want to make sure that we're telling, because we want it to be clear that, you know, all of our things had to come from somewhere, and we want to be honest and respectful to the places that they came from.
Do you think now of yourself as a colleague of Wright's, an apprentice of Wright, or neither?
That's a good question. I'm certainly a scholar of Wright. He passed away almost 35 years before I was born, so I certainly can't say I know him well, but I like to imagine I do sometimes. Yeah, and I'm just very fortunate to be in this position, being able to go to and from Taliesin, Taliesin West. We get to see a different side of Wright here, where you know, he was such a complex person, and you don't quite get that when you're visiting the houses that he built for other people. Here you realize just how busy his life was and how remarkable it is that he produced as much work as he did.
That was Taliesin Collections Coordinator Kyle Dockery speaking with WUWM Susan Bentz about the restoration of the Hillside Theater at Taliesin. The theater reopened over the summer. Did you know you can listen to Lake Effect as a podcast? Just search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcast to download and listen on demand. In about 12 minutes, we'll learn how Forest Home Cemetery becomes a stage for the dead to bring their stories to life.
If you're into something that's spooky, a little spooky, not terribly frightening, and definitely for people who like history and want to know more about Milwaukee, this is the thing to go see.
But first, our astronomy contributor will join us to share what spooky season is like in space. That's coming up on Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. As we continue celebrating spooky season this month, perhaps you like to get a good scare by watching a horror movie set in space. There's the classics such as Aliens or 2001 A Space Odyssey, but we don't need fictionalized versions of space to find it scary. In fact, the longer and harder you think about space, the scarier it can get. UWM's Manfred Olson Planetarium is inviting the public on a spooktacular adventure through the darkest parts of space and chilling stargazing tales in its Creepy Cosmos program. Jean Creighton is the director of the planetarium and Lake Effect's regular astronomy contributor. She shares more about the inspiration for the production.
We had a conversation with my students. This is student-led, this production. And at the beginning, they were talking about, oh, no, the astronauts are going to encourage the audience to embrace space. And I said, stop. If you are an astronaut, you know that you can die in space 50 different ways. You have a whole lot of respect of an environment that really isn't suitable for you. So I said, let's drop that. And furthermore, given that this is a tense time, let's not worry about really talking about the real dangers, the profound dangers that space puts out for us. And let's find things that are more playful and more creepy.
Yes, so I like that.
Yes, thank you for
approving. Agree. Yes, I agree. You know, we don't need to think too hard about what could happen to us in space. I'm worried enough about the astronauts that have had a longer mission than they anticipated already. So let's talk about some of these more general, fun, spooky cosmos topics. And we'll start with one bright, bright one, and it's the sun.
Yes, yes. The sun, people, I think, kind of get bored of. Right? It's just this yellow little thing in the sky. It makes light, but they don't think about it. But in fact, we are following the sun all the time, especially now because it's particularly active. And one of those flares that it produces can make enough energy to power the U.S. for 200,000 years.
Oh my goodness.
Which requires you to be aware of when that's happening so you can put some of your satellites on safe mode. You can make sure that your power grids are ready because you don't want things to fry.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and I can see that happening. You know, we've watched enough movies where something triggers something and then the whole infrastructure goes down, right?
That's right. Now, on the plus side, we do get beautiful northern lights, beautiful
aurora. We've had great auroras this past year.
Yes.
We've been very lucky.
We're likely to get more. Embrace. We are very close to a solar maximum, what it's called, where we expect to see more of these aurora.
Excellent. So we'll stay in, you know, I'm picturing a classic grade school solar system, set up here. We're going to hop over to Venus for our spooky cosmos.
Venus is named after the goddess of love, and let's celebrate the fact that it is the brightest thing in the sky after the sun and the moon, but it really is a nasty place, right? Because it rains poisons, it rains acids, it's the hottest planet in the solar system, and the worst thing is that its atmosphere is so heavy, it would literally crush us.
Oh my God.
So
the marketing really sways you from that.
It really isn't a place that people are going to go to. And, you know, it's named after the goddess of love, but it's not a loving planet.
No, not at all. Now, this next planet, we can kind of have more visual cues that it's not going to be friendly. It's Jupiter.
Yes. Now, what we're leaning into Jupiter, because I think it is the most beautiful planet to look up close at. But we have had some really cool sounds. So there is a current spacecraft called Juno that's going around Jupiter, and we've transposed some of the measurements that we've taken into audible sound, and it's super creepy. Like it's really awesome. And you think, wow. That's what Jupiter is making. And also, Jupiter has gorgeous aurora in and of itself. So hearing the aurora on Jupiter, again, it has to be transposed for us to hear it, gives you a sense of the complexity of Aurora on Jupiter.
And I think one of the most effective ways to set a scene, you know, when we're thinking about spooky season, is the use of sound.
Yes. Yes.
So that really sets a scene there.
Yes.
Now, you know, we could maybe call it on the opposite side of the spectrum, but I imagine there's not much sound happening in black holes of any size. Are there?
So the sound, if any, okay, so first of all, not all black holes are the same, right? We have stellar, what we call stellar black holes. So that's the net product of the end life of a really massive star. And then you have what we call galactic black holes, sort of that beautiful thing that was shown in Interstellar. And that's not spooky, that's glorious. That Kip Thorne, a famous Nobel laureate, in fact, said to one of the producers, maybe it was Spielberg himself, said, surely we can spend a little bit of this huge budget that you have to make a supercomputer give us the image of what a supermassive black hole would look like. And they did.
That's amazing. So, I didn't know that fact. I love that film.
Mm-hmm. So that is the best idea we have of what it would be like to get close to a supermassive black hole. And there is sound there. I assume that if it was completely impossible, then I think Kip Thorne, who was the science advisor, would say, absolutely, you may not do that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think what the sound is, what we're hearing is the tug, the gravitational tug on this poor spacecraft that's getting not quite ripped apart, but close.
Yeah, it's going through a lot of pressure and stress, certainly. And with black holes, you know, they are, as you mentioned, when you have a big step back, beautiful. But the more you think about it, really intimidating, scary things.
Yes, yes. And interestingly, the smaller, the more dangerous.
Okay.
So in the movie, they realistically show you that you could get pretty close to the black hole and you'd be all right. I mean, you'd be scared, of course, but you'd be all right. But one of those stellar black holes, because they're smaller, the gravitational, the tidal forces are on a smaller scale, really dangerous. So probably any fifth grader could tell you that you spaghettify when you get close to a black hole, because literally if you were to jump feet first, it would pull on your feet, it would pull on your head, you would become very hot, thin spaghetti at about 1,000,000 degrees, and you'd be emitting X-rays. We're not meant to do that.
No.
So you wouldn't even get, this would happen before you even cross the event horizon.
Okay.
So not recommended.
Yeah. And definitely part of the spooky cosmos.
Definitely. Right, yes. Here. Avoid.
Yes. Now, what role are comets playing in the spooky cosmos?
Well, comets have often been considered ominous. The presence of a comet in the sky historically has never been, you know, checked. Oh, yep, that's a great sign. Usually things are going south at that point. But again, this is a spooky sound. There's a sound that is made by a spacecraft that got close to this comet. It's been a few years ago now, but the sound is super, super creepy. And what makes it beautiful to me is that you hear the cool sound, but you also see these images are so close that it feels like you could touch it. It feels like a real place. It feels like a set of a horror movie. And I think that gets some mileage right there.
So moving on from the eerie comets, we have neutron stars.
Yes. So my students got really freaked out when they realized that a neutron star has such a strong magnetic field that if it came anywhere close to the Earth, it would wipe out every single credit card.
That was not what I was expecting.
Well,
I was expecting more physical doom and gloom, but that's also a scary thought, I suppose.
If you are an undergraduate student,
yes, true.
When everything you own is on some magnetic tape,
reliant.
On some credit card,
yes.
this is a really alarming prospect.
So true. I love that. Yeah, I need to be reminded of what I was thinking about. Yeah. In college. And finally, one of the favorite topics to think about any time of year, not just during spooky season, is the concept of aliens. Is there life out there? The question of contact, you know?
Yes, yes. Arrival, yes. So We're kind of mentioning this. I mean, we do have programs that we talk fairly regularly about this. So I think they're having a more playful approach. But the fact is that we are now poised with the James Webb Space Telescope and all the other instruments that we have. We are closer and closer to getting answers to this. And if I had to guess, the aliens, I mean, if we find extraterrestrial life, it won't look anything like what, you know, Hollywood has for us. But the idea that even some microbial creature is living on, you know, a planet that's 100 light years away is a mind-blowing, because we go from one to two. And the moment you go from one to two, then the possibility of the whole universe being teeming with life is a real possibility.
Yeah. And, you know, that can be a comfort or a real panic for somebody, you know, because you think of Carl Sagan, you know, we're just a speck of dust, like we're stardust. We're nothing in this whole grand scheme of things. And if, when you really take a look at the scale, yeah, depending the day, it can be comforting, and other times it's a scary thought.
So Audrey, just to be clear, I understand that maybe this is a little alarming, but I do want to lean in on what Carl Sagan said. The nice thing about finding life 100 light years away is that we're not going to interact in any kind of direct way.
True.
So they can be there, we can be here. Our job is to take care of our planet and wave at them from a distance, right?
Yes.
And we'll be fine.
True. Well, all of these things are really interesting to think about and delve a little more into for the season. So, Jean, thank you so much for joining me.
A pleasure always, Audrey.
Jean Creighton is our regular astronomy contributor and the director of UW-Milwaukee's Manfred Olson Planetarium. Their event, Creepy Cosmos, takes place October 18th and 25th. A new season of Bubbler Talk is on the way, and we need some new questions. Submit your questions about the Milwaukee area at WUWM.com. We'll take one more break and then learn what reckonings are coming from the dead at Forest Home Cemetery ahead of their Spirits of the Silent City tours. That's next on Lake Effect on WUWM. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Cemeteries are already considered potentially haunted places to visit during the Halloween season. And this weekend, spirits at Forest Home Cemetery will be coming alive to share their dead reckonings. For the third year, the cemetery will become a stage for professional actors to bring the stories of those laid to rest at Forest Home to life. Notable Milwaukeeans will guide you through stops in the cemetery to learn about the journeys of some of the historical figures buried there. To learn more about Spirits of the Silent City Dead Reckoning, I'm joined by Forest Home Preservation Association Executive Director Sarah Tomlin and one of her special residents. Sarah, welcome back to Lake Effect.
Well, thank you very much. I'm happy to be here again.
So do you want to share with us what Spirits of the Silent City is all about?
Oh, so we really wanted to bring alive the residents of Forest Home Cemetery because their stories are so compelling and amazing. And we wanted to do it in a way that was entertaining. So we partnered with Caper Company, which is a theater company, and we have about over 20 actors portraying our Spirits of the Silent City over two weekends in October. And if you're into something that's spooky, a little spooky, not terribly frightening.
Informative.
But definitely entertaining and definitely for people who like history and want to know more about Milwaukee, this is the thing to go to see.
Yeah, it's very fun and interactive and being able to walk through the cemetery at night visiting these residents, so to speak, and learning more about what they did to make a mark and, you know, mm-hmm. have such a big family plot. We do have a spirit joining us outside of her family's plot, Lenora Cocker. Welcome to the studio. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. You're welcome.
Now, Spirits of the Silent City, as Sarah said, is all about introducing people to some of the notable people buried at Forest Home. And I understand it's your public service to animals that makes you notable, correct?
I did do public service to animals. Animals have been the drive of my life. Even when I was a child, I could go up to a wounded bird and pick it up without a flutter, and it was all fine. So I had my own money, luckily, and I'd been through finishing school, and I graduated from Wesley. So I had some accomplishments, and I turned my focus to animals.
And it was great that you were able to establish your own self and your own work, especially during a time when women especially were most known for their family's accomplishments, right?
Correct. Well, I chose not to get married, and I had the luxury because I had my own money. And I used it to take care of animals. And I had the first sanctuary for animals in Milwaukee. And I also had a sanctuary for horses in my farm in Maquonago when the fire department went to engined trucks. The poor animals were retired, but I gave them a good life.
So, as you mentioned, you've always been drawn to animals. But was there a moment that inspired you to get involved officially with the city, not just taking in stray birds in your backyard?
Oh, there was a little boy. I was at Lake Park at the time. It had just been recently built. It was just beautiful. And this little boy, Knickers, marched up to a policeman and demanded that he arrest the dog catcher. I was at first amused. And then I thought, no, I'm kind of inspired by the courage of this little boy. And I went before the Milwaukee Common Council and asked them to fire the dog catcher as well, and instead have me replace the dog catcher. And I paid for it all.
Well, and you offered your own home and barn to shelter animals until the owners could claim them. What did that look like? Can you paint a picture for us?
The barn was mostly just kind of crated areas, lots of hay. The animals were expected to get along. If they didn't, well, we dealt with them separately. Anyway, and the house, well, let's see. There was dogs in the dining room. The kitchen we kept clean. Some of the rooms upstairs. And, of course, the scullery in the basement. We could house other animals there. And we spread them throughout the house.
You continued to build up your services to eventually support over 120,000 animals by 1929. And I assume the city was pleased with the job you did because you had to rely on the Common Council for help following the financial crash, right? How did your services continue despite the hard financial times?
Well, the financial crash left me broke. The city came through. They gave me a maintenance fund of $1,800, and eventually it went to $8,000. The city paid well, and they were very happy with our services. In fact, it was a catchphrase at the time. If somebody found a stray, they'd say, telephone Miss Cocker.
Now, you get to speak to the living on special occasions, such as Spirits of the Silent City. Are you proud to share what has become your legacy?
I am. I had a job. I had a career. I didn't expect to when I was at finishing school, but, you know, it fed me the rest of my life, and people knew who I was.
Well, and many more Milwaukeeans will continue to know who you are. Sarah, are there any other notable spirits you want to give a little teaser for?
Oh, yes, of course. So the way we do it is that we have spirit guides, and each tour group gets a spirit guide that then takes them into the cemetery to meet other spirits. So some of our notable spirit guides this year is Arthur Davidson, who started Harley-Davidson. We have Lewis Hughes, who is Wisconsin's first Black author. And we have Beulah Brinton. So those are just a few of the people that you'll meet. And you've ever wondered, who is Beulah Brinton? Well, you'll have to come and find out.
Perfect.
And the opportunity to see the beautiful statuary at night, led by someone who's got a flashlight. Oh, it's spooky and it's fabulous.
Well, thank you, Lenore, for giving us a little taste of what to expect at Forest Home. And thank you, Sarah, for joining us as well.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Sarah Tomlin is the executive director of the Forest Home Preservation Association, and Deborah Clifton is an actor who channeled the late Lenore Calker for Forest Home's Spirits of the Silent City. Tours are at the cemetery this weekend on October 18th and 19th, and you can hear Lenore Calker's monologue performed by Clifton and find more information at WUWM.com. And that's Lake Effect for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. If you've missed any of today's conversations or you'd like to take Lake Effect on the go, simply download our podcast. Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to listen to all of our shows on demand. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll meet a Milwaukee woman who's a super fan of super moons, and we'll learn why some leaves change color in the fall. Join us tomorrow at noon on Lake Effect, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.